Next up, we have Sean Laurie, who is currently a PhD student in musicology at McGill University, where he's studying with David Brackett. His work focuses on race, genre, and identity in jazz, blues, and American pop music, including the jazz bass tradition before bebop, rural urban blues, race records, and the work of Mark Ribot. His article, Constructing Robert Johnson, was recently published by the Graduate School of Musicological Explorations. In addition to his studies at McGill, he has been a member of the Mason Gross online faculty since 2010, designing and teaching courses on rock history, jazz, and black music in the United States. So Sean's paper will be Wonderful Destruction, Genre Blending, R&B, and Automotive Chaos in the Blues Brothers.
Thank you. I'm actually going to start off by not talking.
We're so glad to see so many of you lovely people here tonight. We would especially like to welcome all the representatives of the Illinois law enforcement community who have chosen to join us here in the Palace Hotel Ballroom at this time. We certainly hope you all enjoy the show. And remember, people, that no matter who you are and what you do to live and thrive and survive, there are still some things that make us all the same. You, me, them, everybody.
From the film's debut in early 1980, many critics and fans failed to recognize The Blues Brothers as a musical comedy, much less a classic Hollywood musical. While few would argue the centrality of music to the film's structure and entertainment appeal, the musical performances in The Blues Brothers do not always resemble the type of production numbers associated with film musicals. Even when these performances are recognized as numbers, the notion that John Landis' film is a musical comedy in a traditional sense is problematized by a near constant presence of a Saturday Night Live-inspired, dark, absurdist humor, and scenes of automotive carnage. For New York Times critic Janet Maslin, it is this very exhausting overkill, one wrecked police car for every bass note in the score, that makes the film ineffective and far too removed from the genre to bear the moniker musical comedy. I argue, contrary to Maslin's objection, that this overindulgent overkill is just one of the very facets that tie the film to a very long history of over-the-top displays of excess found in many seminal musical comedies. Even if The Blues Brothers is, as Roger Ebert stated in his more favorable review, the Sherman Tank of musicals. In part, it is these musically underscored moments of unrealistic, impossible, often automotive excess, counterbalanced against hyper-ordinary depictions of prisons, roadside bars, and single-room occupancy hotels that make a compelling yet non-traditional case for reading The Blues Brothers as a musical comedy tailor-made for the early 1980s. While I will hopefully demonstrate that The Blues Brothers bears the essential generic markers of a film musical, I contend that the film is not just a musical comedy. In this regard, Ebert's take on the picture as musical Sherman Tank is particularly revealing. Ebert furthers his argument by noting that the musical numbers within the film interrupt what is essentially one gigantic two-hour car chase. He calls the film a big, raucous powerhouse that proves against all the odds that if you're loud enough, vulgar enough, and have enough raw energy, you can make a steamroller into a musical, and vice versa. Building on Ebert's observations, I argue that The Blues Brothers is a dual genre film, at once a musical comedy and automotive pursuit film, creating what Jim Collins notes was a rising phenomena of cross-genre films in the 1980s and 90s. Collins states that these hybrid pictures, quote, enter a narrative universe defined by connections, no longer containable by one set of genre conventions. We encounter instead different sets of genre conventions that intermingle, constituting a profoundly intertextual diegesis, end quote. While this generic duality confounded and put off many critics, I posit that The Blues Brothers actually helps to further enhance the cinema verite, impossible spectacle dichotomy central to so many musicals. Furthermore, I do not see the car chases as interrupting the musical numbers, but rather I see the chases as musical numbers, a position I will explore later in this presentation. It is when the two genre trajectories of chase and musical show combine and collide in the picture's grand finale, when automotive and musical spectacle truly become one, that this dual genre hybridity is most grandly and spectacularly realized. My analysis will address two aspects of the film that allow us to view The Blues Brothers as a well-integrated dual genre musical pursuit film. I will first present an example of a more traditional number from the film to demonstrate Landis's use of dramatic planning within the accepted range of performance types and syntaxes of the film musical. Here I am particularly interested in regard to shifts in play across the visual and oral diegetic threshold, so common in what Rick Altman has recognized as standard fare in many World War II era backstage and folk musical films. I will later present an analytical argument for an expansion of these generally accepted forms of performance to include musical car chase routines as a means of better understanding the Blues Brothers as an auto musical comedy. Although lacking the literal backstage or theater environment for much of the film, the Blues Brothers is best thought of as belonging to a show or backstage musical subgenre, the later a classification that Martin Rubin might argue accounts for the film's review tendencies and tour of the town progression of scenes within this loose narrative construction. Like Nashville, Saturday Night Fever, and a host of other backstage musicals that preceded it, the Blues Brothers adheres to a jukebox formula, drawing its songs and almost its entire score from pre-existing compositions and recordings. Rather than the concurrently trending styles of country and disco, however, the music of the Blues Brothers draws mostly from soul, blues, R&B of the 1950s and 1960s, what one reviewer dubbed an antidote to the disco condition. The film's repurposing of older black styles as anti-disco, anti-populist, by a pair of white singing musicians, coupled with cameo appearances by major figures in 1960s soul and blues movements, begs for an evaluation of the film in terms of cultural appropriation, representation, misplaced notions of authenticity, and possibly even as thinly veiled modern-day minstrelsy. While it may not be particularly difficult to interpret the film through this lens, I find that this reading lacks the necessary nuance to take into account Belushi and Aykroyd's genuine affection for black music. Belushi, in particular, was quite forceful in his claims that they intended their act as a tribute to the artists they covered, while recognizing the potential issues this type of tribute raised, a notion underscored in his interview with Rolling Stone in 1980, when he states, "One of the blues magazines said it's a shame that the kids had to learn blues through the mass appeal of an ersatz album like Briefcase Full of Blues. And they're right. It's too bad that they're not buying Fenton Robinson or John Lee Hooker. But you know what? The matter of fact is, we can do something about that, and we are." For the purpose of this presentation, I will leave these and many other issues and critiques largely unattended in order to focus on exploring the ways the Blues Brothers works within, pushes the boundaries of, and engages in an ironic play with the tropes and conventions of the film musical genre. This approach seems most fitting in light of the paucity of scholarship on the movie, none of which engages with the film in terms of music, much less its function as a musical comedy. The Blues Brothers opens with a wide shot of an industrial complex just outside Chicago, underscored with accompanying diegetic sounds of steelworks, furnaces, and sirens. The next shot shows Joliet Correction Center, where the camera follows Jake Blues as he is escorted through a prison block to his release with Fenton Robinson's blues tune, Somebody Loan Me a Dime, playing diegetically on a tinny-sounding radio in the background. Immediately following his processing, Jake, now in his signature black suit and tie, fedora and sunglasses, is reunited with his brother, Elwood, who, dressed in matching attire, is waiting outside. As the pair meet up in the street and drive away from the prison, Taj Mahal's 1968 composition, She Caught the Katie, plays non-diegetically in the background. From these initial scenes, the audience is introduced to our protagonists, while a tone of gritty, blues-scored realism is established for the film. Through the middle acts of the film, the Blues Brothers encounter a cast of antagonists, including a country band, a local chapter of neo-Nazis, the Chicago Police Department, and a rather homicidal Carrie Fisher, who spend the remainder of the film pursuing them. The narrative of the chase in the film's main plot, that is to say Jake and Elwood's mission from God, consisting of putting the band back together and playing one last big show, is balanced against and developed through a series of musical numbers featuring cameo performances by black music luminaries Aretha Franklin, Ray Charles, and Cab Calloway. The most heralded and memorable of these cameos, Aretha Franklin's Think Number, demonstrates one of the film's most direct use of musical comedy tropes, song as an expression of a character's emotion and inner thoughts in lyric time. The number, set in Franklin's Soul Food Cafe, begins with Jake and Elwood attempting to persuade Matt Guitar Murphy to leave his wife, played by Franklin, and his job at the restaurant to rejoin the band. The routine's enhanced musical and performance reality sidesteps the narrative time of the film and contrasts starkly with the grungy setting and the grease-stained aprons of Murphy and Franklin, which they wear and underscore the urban realism that serves as the backdrop of most of the film. So we'll watch this clip in its entirety, both to see how kind of this genre, how the film musical kind of contagion spreads through the diner, and also because it's really a great scene.
And I'll make the decision concerning my...
You better think about what you're saying. You better think about the consequences of your act.
Oh, shut up, woman.
You better think.
A side note about this scene. Apparently, Aretha Franklin was terrible at lip syncing. She just couldn't do it. So there's a lot of kind of awkward shots where you see kind of the back quarter of her head. And that's because she just really couldn't, she just couldn't do it to the track. She's so, apparently just so used to changing things up, I guess. Anyway, we'll move on. In this scene, we witness what Raymond Knapp might describe as the musical number's ability to transform the ordinary into the extraordinary, if only through the performance of a soul music icon. It's worth noting that only in the cameo appearances by black artists in the film does this transformation occur, this slip, this step outside of diegetic space and time. The film reaches its finale as the big gig is at last finally staged. In attendance are the various antagonists, including the Illinois State Police, who, in an absurd turn fitting a musical the musical genre, allow the band to perform before attempting to arrest the Blues Brothers. The backstage action finally comes to fruition, and the show is going off just as planned, thus fulfilling the standard narrative convention of a Hollywood musical. This, however, only resolves the musical comedy trajectory of the film, and therefore the Blues Brothers' performance at the Palace Ballroom is only part of the film's resolution. The car chase is as yet unresolved. The show finale in a backstage folk musical such as the Blues Brothers is not always an exclusively theatrical performance, but as Rick Altman has pointed out, can also draw from, quote, a long line of indigenous entertainment forms, each of which could be treated as a staged finale reminiscent of Busby Berkeley's final numbers, parade, football game, rodeo, and so forth, end quote. In the next and last number, we see just such a device, although in a form not utilized by Hollywood before, bringing the musical narrative and automotive pursuit together, combining them into a 20-minute grand finale musical car chase number. The number starting on the actual stage is set to Robert Johnson's 12-bar blues standard, Sweet Home Chicago. The lyrics of the first chorus, "Come on, baby, don't you want to go back to the same old place, sweet home Chicago," telegraph the eventual and physical destination for the resolution of the number. The routine starts with three choruses sung by Jake and Elwood while still on stage. Following these rather traditional choruses, the band continues to play, taking turns soloing as various bits of dialogue are spoken over the tune. While Jake and Elwood make their escape, the music slowly fades out as they move farther and farther from the source. For the next few moments of action, we hear only diegetic sound and dialogue. That is, until the car chase begins. To start the chase portion of the number, the camera cuts to a shot of a dark, empty highway, where we hear a one-measure drum fill as the band slash soundtrack joins in, again, still performing Sweet Home Chicago. Jake and Elwood's car, the Bluesmobile, enters the frame with a dozen police cars and a Winnebago full of angry country musicians in hot pursuit. I intentionally use the dual phrases here, band still and soundtrack again, to draw attention to the interpretive possibilities of what I consider a pivotal moment in the finale. One could hear the music, which is clearly a continuation of the preceding performance, as incidental, mere underscoring for the chase. I argue, however, that this is not the case. A close listening reveals that this blues chorus, including drum fill, is lifted directly from the earlier live performance heard emanating from the band in the Palace Ballroom stage, essentially creating a musical deja vu. The music has unquestionably shifted from diegetic to non-diegetic. However, I hear it as an oral link back to the stage performance, and as such, allows us to read the next 11 minutes of automotive excess and destruction as part of the Big Show finale. For the sake of time, I will not indulge in a detailed account of the chase. I will merely mention that it includes more than 40 cars traveling at speeds of over 110 miles an hour, many of which fly through the air, roll, collide, end up in bodies of water, and fall from great heights. Of these, none, not even the Bluesmobile, survives the pursuit. What then to make of all this business of car chases? Why does a film about music, a musical comedy no less, need a secondary genre coding of automotive pursuit and wanton destruction? Moreover, why does it work? To answer these questions, I think it's important to consider the time in which the film was made. In summing up his thoughts on the film musical, Altman notes that, quote, "Society and the musical film, along with other popular genres from Hollywood and elsewhere, stand in a symbiotic relationship to each other. Each grows out of and into the other according to a simple scheme of mutual reinforcement," end quote. Much like the film's emphasis on blues and R&B in opposition to the dominant disco, the desire to bring destructive automotive spectacle into film was a sign of the times, a sign of a powerful anti-establishment trend present in 1970s American society. In a recent article about automotive destruction in American film, Paul Newland notes that in the mid to late 1970s, a veritable golden age of automotive pursuit was underway, particularly in the orgiastic celebration of destruction and stunt-as-gag subgenres. Newland argues that the car crashes, like the one staged in Blues Brothers, can be enjoyed as slapstick comedy that exploit the desire of film spectators to witness the willful destruction of public and private property on an increasingly and unprecedented scale. In this frame, the Blues Brothers' celebration of blues and R&B and automotive destruction is part and parcel of the same anti-disco, anti-establishment, dual-genre, auto-musical comedy aesthetic in which a thumping bass note has the same semantic power as a wrecked police cruiser. Thank you.
We're all timed. Questions?
This is a comment, really. not really a question, but it also occurs to me that car chases themselves are a visual counterpoint to disco culture as well. It's not just the music, but you know, disco money didn't tend to go to giant, what do we call these? I'm being a disco money guy myself, I forget. But these monster truck rallies where everything gets destroyed.
Monster truck rallies, I think.
Demolition Derby.
Yes. Sure. And I mean, as a contrast, I mean, I think if you know, anyone who attended Mel's paper this morning, you know, the disco demolition derby was kind of the same held in Chicago as well, I believe. Sure. So there's definitely a link of wanton destruction of all sorts, whether baseball stadiums or automobiles, linked with this kind of anti-disco aesthetic.
I'll ask a question. The link between the blues and Chicago is clear enough. Is there any link between the car chase and Chicago? Is there any?
Not to my knowledge. Actually, there seems to be loosely more of a link between the car chase and Toronto, in that Dan Aykroyd was apparently a gearhead. He loved cars. He had tons of these kind of old cars. And it was more his idea to kind of put the car thing into this. And he's a Toronto native, so that's closest I can tie. As far as a link to Chicago and car chases, that's not something I'm aware of.
Probably in line with Jonathan, it's kind of thinking aloud, but you know, both car chases and musical numbers are highly choreographed bits of cinema. I mean, they really are comparable in a lot of ways in terms of how you have to set them up and establish them and work them cinematically. So, I mean, there is an interesting affinity going on there.
Oh, certainly. And I mean, they do play a lot like dance numbers. You know, the
cars splitting off.
Yeah. You know, in the extended chase scene, you have all sorts of, you know, you have those kind of merging and re-merging and the crashes coming from different angles. It's all, you know. Yeah, exactly.
It's been a few years since I've seen the film, but like, what, if any, is the musical accompaniment to
the final chase is entirely is the 12 bar blues at Sweet Home Chicago, and it runs underneath, it fades in and out as dialogue, but it's underlying throughout, which is why I kind of read this as kind of a continuation of the finale from the stage. The mall car, chase scene I think is an instrumental version of Everybody Needs Someone to Love, which is the clip I played right in the beginning, which this really, the music starts, actually this is something I just cut for time, was that the music on that starts the second they enter the mall. So if anyone's familiar with the film, they crash into like the wall of a mall, and there's a chase for about 3 minutes inside of this Chicago strip mall. And that music is timed within to the beginning and the end of that.
But there's also a part of the final chase scene, because I grew up watching this movie and I love it, where they play the Ride of the Valkyries.
Right, very briefly. When the Nazis are, when the Nazis are flying through the air when they've jumped a bridge, yes, it does. That is actually one of the few moments that doesn't fall in this kind of soul.
Why would they do that? I don't understand.
Okay, well, I guess we'll thank everybody in the panel, I think, for their presentation.